You're listening to A Light at the Other Side, where we're sharing stories of resilience, healing, and hope. We share the experiences of adoptees, domestic violence survivors, military veterans, and more, so some episodes may contain potentially triggering accounts of trauma. To fully appreciate the light, we must sometimes peer into the dark. On this week's episode, we're going to talk about what it takes to share the stories that we do, those of us who are writers, artists, creators. It's an important discussion to have because for many years, I just thought I couldn't do it. I couldn't possibly share my life story out loud. And then I did. And it's actually been really great. I hold the keys, not you. The emotional labor of unlocking a memory to share a story. I wander around the yard, watching my dog sniff 7 bushes before deciding where to pee. I am numb, zoned out, a cardigan wrapped around me on a muggy 89-degree evening. My husband watches from a distance. He doesn't speak except one, "You okay?" He now knows me well enough to know not to push, not to smother, and to watch from afar. Writing about my past is hard. Exposing raw nerves, sharing painful truths, reliving scary things. Dancing around making my story someone else's indictment. I don't name names, but I share my lived truth, and it wouldn't be hard to track down who I'm talking about. Most of the characters are still alive. I still shake off tendrils of guilt as they come creeping up the back of my neck as I write, as I edit, as I ever so cautiously parse out what I'm going to say and how I shall say it, what word I will use and which I won't, and which I will only reserve for later. I am reminded of the countless spiritual advisors or Christian counselors, not allowed to call themselves therapists, rightfully so, because they have literally no qualifications for therapy, who have admonished me for speaking out loud, much less audiences of thousands or more, about the abuse I endured in the home of a pastor. They used Bible verses and slick catchphrases to try to shut me down, make me feel guilt for things done to me at 8 years old, to trick my brain into associating shame and stigma with speaking up. It worked for a long time, and the entire time it was poisoning me. Bottling up all of that hurt was like a cancer eating away at my soul. I had to get it out, and I had to take control of my own narrative. When I began therapy with my first real therapist, she told me early on, imagine you have a set of keys, like a big round set of keys like a janitor would have. You hold a key for each of your most primal memories, and I nor anyone else has the right to force you to use that key. But you are also not obligated to keep that room locked forever. You are allowed to open it, to expose it, to air it out, to process it, and maybe, hopefully, to purge it. I loved that, not only because I love good visual imagery, but it gave me the power. Every counselor before then had encouraged me to not lean on my own understanding, but to trust God implicitly with how the years of rape and abuse were part of His plan. The idea that a deity had some plan for my pain was always so sickening to me. How could child rape possibly factor into God's plan? Taking back the power of how I accessed and processed my experiences began to shift my thinking and eventually my behavior. Another tangible way this imagery helped me process my abuse was that my mind took on this vision of this large ring of keys and extrapolated out an additional layer. Me, as an adult, holding the key ring and guiding my inner child through those corridors of memories. In my mind, I am strong and wise and patient and kind. I like to think I am those things, and I strive to be every day. I am wearing a long apron, like some that I own. One day, when I chose to access a certain painful memory for a therapy session, I meditated before the session, and my mind went here. I walked down the corridor of my mind, back, way back to the seedy, dark passageways far, far back, with cobwebs in the corners, dirt on the walls, flickering fluorescent lights, and I pull out a key. I open a door, and my little inner child, who has been trailing reluctantly behind me, peeks. I spread out my apron to shield her eyes. I softly say, "You don't have to see this anymore," and I gently turn her, push her back to the light. She runs to memories of Granddaddy's farm with green pastures and cheerwine floats, while I turn into the room and do the hard work for her. I can be soft to my inner child while doing the very adult, very hard work of airing out my soul. I hold the keys. I have begun to find other writers and creators who have shared similar experiences, and I find so much validation in their work. I hate that they endured similar pain, but reading their words lets me know I'm not alone, and that there are others out there, and that we are all on this healing journey together. It's hard to do this. It's very hard. I wish I could sit down and write a lighthearted satire that makes everyone laugh and gets lots of positive reactions. I do hope that one day I'll be more driven to craft those pieces. It's hard to be known as the writer who is difficult to read, too heavy, or too much. And yet, there's always that one comment or text or message or private note. This was my life too. That one soul who felt seen by reading someone's words, who is saying the hard part out loud. I've burned lots of bridges simply by talking about my truth. I struggled with this for years until I read Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird, and the following quote leapt off the page and landed right in my lap and yelled at me. "You own everything that happened to you. Tell your stories. If people wanted you to write warmly about them, they should have behaved better." This quote gave me my freedom, as I'm sure it has to countless other writers. It put things in perspective in that blunt, clean, straightforward way that Miss Lamott has. It made it very simple to make the decision to keep writing and to write about more and more personal things, because she's right. If they wanted me to write warmly about them, they should have behaved better. If I could give her a huge hug for setting my words free, I would. I've kept Bird by Bird on my bedside table ever since. It's had coffee spilled on it. My daughter has made a few scribbles in it. It's got some dog hair on it, even. It's a well-loved talisman that I keep nearby for strength. Now I seek to share that strength with others. Write your stories. First of all, because you deserve to. You deserve to share, to purge, to celebrate, and to mourn. You deserve to allow yourself to feel and process things you've kept shut up for too long. You deserve to connect with others who have experienced the same or similar traumas and have a community of people who understand, who can read between the lines and see you and hear you as authentically as they see themselves. And if you don't write, paint, or dance, or sing, or pound it out on drums. You deserve a chance to move past it and become the person you were always intended to be before the trauma. You and only you own your keys. Do not be bound by silence forever. Unlock, purge, and set yourself free. So in case I haven't covered it already, I grew up in the South. And in the South, there is most certainly a code of silence, even in, I think, some of the most normal families. The saying, "You don't air dirty laundry," is certainly a familiar phrase in this region. The idea that the problems that exist within your household are deeply personal and shouldn't be shared is something that's drummed into our minds very early on in childhood. And in a lot of ways, there's definitely value to that. People deserve privacy in their homes, and they deserve for their embarrassing moments to be kept at home within the family. Nobody wants embarrassing moments to be shared, you know, with the world. I had a conversation with my kids about this when they began using social media, and one of them filmed a video in which you could hear me fussing at two of the other kids and posted it on social media. And I was like, okay, that's not appropriate. You know, they're having a moment that could quite easily be interpreted as embarrassing by their peers. And you just don't need to put that on the internet. Okay. Some things stay in the house purely for the respect and privacy of those family members. But there's a fine line And this is where a lot of these families, and I can only speak to my experience, so Southern Christian families, there's a fine line where if you repeatedly tell small children that you don't air dirty laundry and that family problems stay in the house, they will hide abuse for years, for decades even. And this is incredibly common, incredibly common. So I've had a lot of people from my hometown message me when I began writing and they began reading my writing on the internet. And it was a little bit of a mixed bag. I actually had people angry at me because their perception of my adopters from outside the home, from strictly how they appeared in public, was that they were such good people, there's no way what I was saying could possibly be correct about them. So I was on some vendetta to get back my adopters. I should be ashamed of myself. I was making this stuff up. And I don't know, I guess I'm glad I've been through a lot of therapy and a lot of healing because I largely ignored that feedback. There's no way that anyone could know the type of people they were unless they lived with them, unless you saw them behind closed doors. My adopters were very, very good at putting on a great public face. They are leaders in the community. They've got all kinds of awards and accolades and, you know, okay. I know what I lived. I know what I lived. And then there was another type of feedback, and it broke my heart a little bit. There were people that I knew throughout my life, some of them classmates, who reached out to me privately and said, "This happened to me too. I know exactly what you're talking about. I know what you're dealing with because it happened to me too." And there's something really chilling to think back about going to high school and, you know, being on a homecoming committee with some of these people. And I would go to school wearing my mask and they would go to school wearing theirs. And that's how we interacted with one another, as if we were these carefree teenagers in the 90s. And we were hiding so many other people's awful secrets. And we were going home and dealing with grown adults' behavior and words and abuse. And we were absorbing it all and going out into the world pretending nothing was wrong. And we were keeping their secrets for them. And that just really sucks. It really broke my heart to receive some of those messages. And it really opened my eyes to how systemic some of this stuff is, and how maybe we need to ease up on the don't air your dirty laundry talk and start to facilitate more open conversations where honesty can be valued for the sake of improving our families and improving our relationships. Recently, I was out to lunch with some of my family, and the restaurant was really crowded, and we were seated very close to another table, and there was an older couple, a woman who looked to be around my age with two small children, and another young man that looked maybe a little younger than us. And so through their conversations, it became pretty apparent that these were the parents and their daughter and son, her brother. And at some point, the mom said something that was a little crass. Like, we would think it's crass nowadays. It would be acceptable to say this like 30 years ago. And the woman, who was my age, stopped her mom and said, "Nope, I'm going to draw a boundary right there. We're just not going to say that. Okay, we're just not going to talk about that." And so her mom was clearly miffed and changed the topic, but had to make a little snide remark. And a little further into the conversation, the dad looked at a family coming in the door, and they had a child with them. And he said out loud, "Free Willy, am I right?" And this woman, again, said, "Okay, I'm going to stop you right there. I'm going to put that boundary down. We are not going to comment on other people's bodies, especially negatively, in front of my children. That's not the type of household that we have. That's not behavior that I find appropriate. So I'm just going to draw that boundary that we're not going to have that kind of language around my kids." And her mom clearly had enough and sort of snapped on her and said, "Why is everything so difficult with you? Why do you have to make these comments? And why does everything have to be so difficult? We just can't go to lunch without your comments." Now, never mind that it was the dad's comment that was grossly inappropriate. It was the daughter drawing the boundary and calling out the bad behavior that was addressed, not the horrible comment that spurred, you know, that conversation. And I thought, man, that is so typical. I feel like that's really, really typical of Southern families. We're in a lot of them, not all. I know some incredibly healthy families with incredibly healthy grandparents who love open communication and healthy communication. But in a lot of Southern families, if you address a problem out loud, you become the problem. You become the black sheep because you have said out loud other people's bad behavior and how that bad behavior affected you. And a lot of times, unfortunately, in families like that, you have to choose speaking up, talking out loud about the things that happened to you, or staying in the family. And that's really, really heartbreaking. That was part of the general commentary that I got from some of those people who messaged me privately, was that they went through this. Some of them literally went through sexual abuse in their home and haven't even talked about it out loud. They still routinely see their abusers and they have to be nice to their face. And they have to keep the peace, so they have to carry around that person's shame forever to be a part of the family. Because if they ever talk about it out loud, and this includes talking about it in terms of, "I don't want my child around that person because I know what they did to me," even those types of conversations can cause someone to become the black sheep of the family, simply wanting to keep their children protected from someone they know is an abuser, can cause them to be completely excommunicated from their family. That really broke my heart. Not only reading the messages and realizing that we were going through these, you know, horrific things sort of side by side, parallel during those years, and we never knew it. We saw each other's mask at school and we interacted with one another on that surface level while we then went home to our respective nightmares. That broke my heart. But then knowing that these people were still in families with abusers and they didn't feel like they could share their stories out loud. They couldn't talk about what they went through because it would hurt their abuser, because it would shame the family. It would bring shame to the family. And they're going through their lives right now, carrying that shame and carrying that weight and living in that silence. Part of my vision when I started A Light at the Other Side was to help people find their voice and help them unlock that door, whether it be a door of shame or the fear of retaliation from the abuser, finding a path out of that. Because I was stuck, even with therapy, even with various types of sort of self-healing, journaling, meditation, and therapy, I was still stuck until I began sharing my story with others. And it wasn't very public at first. It certainly, I didn't just jump into writing. I joined private closed Facebook groups of other people who had been through what I've been through and started speaking in those groups. I felt safe there because there's no way anybody else on Facebook could see what was being said. So I did feel a good amount of safety and security in those groups in starting to speak and starting to say what happened to me. And I was embarrassed to start sharing those stories because I thought I would be judged. There's a great deal of shame that's attached to abuse, but particularly sexual abuse. And just speaking on it out loud was terrifying. For many, many, many years of my life, speaking it out loud brought me so much shame. So the very first time I shared in a public setting was in a private Facebook group, and I shared what happened to me. And immediately there was a flood of comments, feedback, support, and over, me too, me too, me too. It happened to me too. And I promise you it gets better. I promise you there's healing on the other side. I promise you. You're taking the first step in talking about it. Now you need to work through it. But the support in those comments and knowing that other people had been through the same thing and they were saying the hard part out loud. And so when I began writing on Medium, I started getting lots of comments in the comment section that were all along the same line. This happened to me too. This is how my story went. And I thought, why are you not telling your own story then? You just told this incredibly heart-wrenching story and it's buried in the comments of my story. I want you to write this story. I want you to write it because you wrote it beautifully. It's very eloquent. It's very heart-wrenching. And you deserve to have your own platform for sharing that information. When I'd been writing for a few months and I'd been tossing around the idea of a podcast for years, I started thinking, how can I pull all of these pieces together? So I write on Medium, and on Medium we have publications that are like online magazines. So I started two. Adoptere, which is specifically for the voices of adoptees. That is primary in our publication. We can and will publish adopters, other satellite parties like attorneys or social workers that have experience with adoption. But we really focus on uplifting the voices of adoptees because those voices have been silenced for so long, so long. And my other publication is Served, because I haven't written at length about my military service. But when I did, again, in the comments, these veterans were dropping insane stories just in the comments of my story. And I would beg them, please, please pull this out. Write your own piece and I will publish it for you. Okay. And so I made an entire publication specifically for veterans because the stories they told were so heart-wrenching and so tragic. And the narrative that we have of both adoptees and veterans is largely, overwhelmingly composed by people who are neither of those things. The narrative around adoption is driven by the adoption industry, okay? Adoption agencies, attorneys. These are people that seek to gain from adoption. So they're going to whitewash it and they're going to make it look like the greatest thing ever because that is their job. That's their livelihood. That's how they make money. They're getting rich off of adoption. So the overwhelming narrative is from religious institutions and adoption agencies. Very little has been heard from adoptees themselves until just now, like the past few years. Likewise, with veterans, the narrative around what it means to be a veteran, what military service actually looks like, is overwhelmingly from politicians. Politicians who have some stake in the game, who want to further some bill or, you know, just look good on Veterans Day or Memorial Day or something. Very little of the narrative is from veterans themselves. Because a lot of veterans, you know, they get that DD-214, they retire, and they just never want to talk about it again. They compartmentalize, they shut it down. And I've been talking to a lot of, especially Vietnam vets, as they're getting older, they're in their 70s, and they're saying, I've got to talk about this now because I can't take this to the grave. This stuff has been slowly killing me for 40 years. I cannot continue to live like this. I need to tell this story. And they're telling it. They're starting to tell their stories, and they do not line up with the narrative that we've heard about military service from politicians on either side, really. But when you actually hear feedback from veterans themselves, that makes everyone uncomfortable because it counters the narrative that we've all heard for all these years. So auditing the narrative is a big theme of my work. I want the truth to lead the way. When I was 8 years old, I wanted to be a hard-hitting investigative reporter. I used to write press on an index card and stick it in the brim of a hat that my granddaddy had in his closet. And I wanted to be that person who told important stories that changed people's perceptions and minds. The entire field of journalism has changed and, for the most part, died in the sense that we know it, the sense of those of us who grew up before Y2K. We know what journalism used to be and we know what it's become, and it's just not what we would call journalism anymore. But I am still very passionate about telling stories and auditing existing narratives. A lot of narratives we have in place in our society are made by people who have not actually experienced that thing. We have narratives about immigrants who are not immigrants. We have narratives about veterans from people who are not veterans. We have narratives about adoptees from people who are not adopted. We have these crafted narratives that have been very carefully and well crafted to achieve a certain end. But what it completely ignores is truth and reality. And what I want to do with my project is to illuminate the truth. When I say a light at the other side, it kind of has two meanings, okay? Number one, when you go through the darkness of deep depression, of trauma, sometimes you don't feel like there's ever going to be a light at the other side. You're just going to be in this darkness for the rest of your life. And part of my mission is to encourage people that there is a light past this, okay? If you put in the work, if you work on your own healing, you will get through the darkness. You will. It doesn't last forever. You have to put work in, but it doesn't last forever. And number two, the concept of light and shedding light on topics that have been largely false, that have been taken over by whatever other parties who had interest in twisting the narrative to something that suited them and benefited them, and in the process, eliminating or squashing the truth. People don't want to hear the truth from adoptees. They get very emotional, very angry, very quickly when adoptees tell their truth. It's such a bizarre phenomenon to watch. And I watch it live all the time. I'm starting to follow a lot of content creators who make videos, writings, podcasts about being adopted. And a lot of times the comment sections are just wild with people that just want to deny our lived reality and tell us that what we're saying is not true, it's not real, we're making things up, we're seeking attention, and you know, the kicker, we should be grateful that we were adopted at all. So it's wild that people have this emotional reaction to something they've never experienced, and they can never possibly comprehend how it feels to be in those shoes. So my project is to take your hand and to say, no matter what you've been through, you have the strength within yourself to rebuild your life in a way that's pleasing to you, in a way that's comfortable to you, in a way that feels safe to you. And it may involve walking through some darkness, going through therapy, bringing up repressed memories, sorting through the really tough things that you've lived through and airing them out in the light is hard. And it does get dark and it does get sad. It is difficult. But beyond that, there is so much freedom and healing and peace. I can't stress enough the peace that you have in your life when you even begin to address your trauma. That's what I want for A Light at the Other Side. I'm always accepting feedback of any kind. You can find me on Medium, go through my articles, comment on them. You can always email me. I'll give my email address again. I've done it once. I'll do it again. I love getting feedback. My email address is itsjustmelissak, itsjustmelissak, @gmail.com. Email me if you want to come on my podcast as an interviewee, if you want to read some work of your own, if you're interested in just getting started writing or creating or cracking open this lifetime of secrets that you've held and where to even begin, because I would love to help you find your voice and to elevate your voice so that you too can be a light to the people around you and strangers across the globe that you have no idea are listening or could possibly ever listen or read your words and find some value in them. They're out there. There are people who will listen and who will read and who will identify with you. So if you're ready to start that journey, I'd love to help you. And if you just want to keep tuning in, that's amazing also. I appreciate you with my whole heart, and I look forward to seeing you next week.